PS systems, hazardous materials, the defense industry's industrial base in entirety. Without SCADA systems working, all hell breaks loose all at once. SCADA systems regulate everything from boiler pressure at manufacturing plants to the mixing of chemicals at water treatment facilities across America. SCADA systems control ventilation and filtering systems, open and close valves, control large motors and pumps, switch electronic circuits on and off. With the failure of SCADA systems, thousands of subway trains, passenger trains, and freight trains traveling in every direction, many on the same tracks, collide with one another, crash into walls and barriers, or derail. Elevators stop between floors or speed to the ground and crash. Satellites, including the International Space Station, shift out of position and begin falling to Earth. America's 53 remaining nuclear power plants, all now operating on backup systems, have just begun to collectively run out of time. In the air, the effects are unconditionally nightmarish. It is peak operating time for commercial aircraft across the United States. Thousands of commercial airplanes using fly-by-wire technology systems lose wing and tail controls, lose cabin pressure and landing gear, lose instrument landing systems as they head violently toward the ground. One class of passenger aircraft is mercifully spared, namely the older model 747s used by the Defense Department for its doomsday planes. 747 pilots still use a foot pedal and a yoke mechanically linked to the control surfaces, Yago tells us. There's no fly-by-wire technology there. The critical infrastructure systems on the ground fail in succession. Without SCADA systems controlling the more than 2.6 million miles of pipeline through which America's oil and gas products flow, millions of valves rupture and explode. Combustion sensors on coal-fired boiler systems suffer the wrong mix of air and fuel, causing them to ignite and blow. With the motorized valves on America's water delivery systems no longer under anyone's control, billions of gallons of water passing through America's aqueducts surge uncontrollably. Dams burst. Mass flooding begins sweeping infrastructure and people away. There will be no more fresh water, no more toilets to flush, no sanitation, no street lights, no tunnel lights, no lights at all, only candles until there are none left to burn. No gas pumps, no fuel, no ATMs, no cash withdrawals, no access to money, no cell phones, no landlines, no calling 911, no calls at all, no emergency communication systems, except some high-frequency HF radios, no ambulance services, no hospital equipment that works. Sewage spills out everywhere. It takes less than 15 minutes for disease-carrying insects to swarm, to feed on piles of human waste, on garbage, on the dead. America's complex system of systems comes to a sudden, apocalyptic halt. In the ensuing fear and mayhem, people revert to their most basic mammalian instincts, to using their five senses, their hands, and their feet. People everywhere sense imminent danger all around. They sense that whatever just happened is the beginning of the savagery, not the end. People abandon their vehicles and begin to flee on foot. They exit buildings, run downstairs and outdoors. People in subway trains and on buses, in halted elevator cars, work to pry open emergency exits and doors. They crawl, walk, and run for their lives. The most basic human instinct is to survive. Evolution got us this far, from hunter-gatherers to men on the moon, from spear fishermen to people who sing happy birthday to one another across continents on Zoom. Humans are wired to advance. Humans do whatever it takes. And yet, nuclear war zeroes it all out. Nuclear weapons reduce human brilliance and ingenuity, love and desire, empathy and intellect to ash. In this moment, the most horrifying part of the shock and the despair is revelation about what life will be like from this second forward, followed by the stark realization that no one did anything substantial to prevent nuclear World War III. That this didn't have to happen, and now it is too late. History lesson number 9, Apes on a Treadmill. One day in 1975, Foreign Policy magazine published an essay written by a defense official turned nuclear disarmament advocate named Paul C. Warnke. This essay, called Apes on a Treadmill, remains prescient to this day. In it, Warnke criticized not only how insanely dangerous nuclear weapons are, but how wasteful the entire nuclear arms race is and always has been. He called it a monkey-see, monkey-do phenomenon, with all participants copying one another's aggressive moves and getting absolutely nowhere, like unintelligent beasts. Even worse, Warnke pointed out, was that the runners in the race didn't seem to realize there was no way for any one person or any one group to actually win. That we are all apes on a treadmill, slaving away. The visual seared in people's minds, and the article faded from view. Then, in 2007, writing in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a group of young scientists inadvertently provided a fascinating new twist to the apes on a treadmill idea. The scientists were exploring bipedalism, the theory that our ancient ancestors learned to walk upright because it took less energy than quadrupedal knuckle walking. To advance this hypothesis, they equipped 5 chimpanzees and 4 people with oxygen masks and then put them on treadmills. The scientists collected data about oxygen usage in the apes and in the humans to see what they might learn. They wanted to know if energy expenditure could account for why some apes evolved to develop the intellect of today's humans, while others stayed behind in the jungle as unenlightened beasts. In gathering the data, an unexpected anecdote came to the fore, one that shines a light on Warnke's essay. As it turns out, some of the chimps didn't want to participate in the treadmill experiment. Anthropologist David Reichlin, one of the scientists involved, told Reuters journalist Will Dunham what he observed of the apes. These guys, the apes, are smart enough that they would hit the stop button on the treadmill when they were done, Reichlin said. In other words, if an ape didn't want to continue on the race to nowhere, they'd just hit the stop button or they'd jump off. A question remains. If the apes know how to get off the treadmill, Why don't we? 57 minutes. The handmaidens of the apocalypse arrive. U.S. Strategic Command headquarters gets hit first by an onslaught of nuclear warheads launched from Russian subs that surfaced off the East Coast minutes ago. The warheads strike off at Air Force Base in Nebraska with the goal of destroying Stratcom's underground Global Operations Center. This nuclear command and control bunker was designed to withstand a direct hit from a single 1 megaton nuclear weapon, not necessarily a catastrophic bombardment by multiple 100 kiloton warheads near simultaneously. Decades ago, defense scientists calculated that one bomb with a yield of 1 megaton destroys 80 to 100 square miles, not counting the mass fire, while 10 smaller bombs, each with a yield of 100 kilotons, destroys an area more than twice that size. The light around each of the exploding weapons superheats the air to millions of degrees, creating massive nuclear fireballs that expand in diameter at millions of miles per hour. The heat so intense, all concrete surfaces explode, metal melts, humans transform into combusting carbon. Some people below ground will burn to death slowly. Others will carbonize instantly, depending on where they are when the bombs detonate. Offutt Air Force Base, as well as all of Greater Omaha, Nebraska, birthplace of the pink hair curler and butter brickle ice cream, and a great majority of the nearly 500,000 people living here, are incinerated. At nearly the same time, another torrent of 100-kiloton warheads strikes Raven Rock Mountain Complex in Pennsylvania. The payload yields don't mean much of anything anymore. 100, 400, or 500 kilotons, 1 or 2 megatons, MIRVed or not MIRVed. Everything in America's nuclear command and control system is in the process of being systematically destroyed. The original Raven Rock building plans were drawn by the same engineer who designed Hitler's bunker beneath Berlin. In the end of that war, it wasn't the barrage of Allied firepower that killed Hitler. He shot himself in the head. The Raven Rock Mountain Complex is supposed to function as a centerpiece of America's continuity of operations plans to keep the federal government performing essential functions, even after a nuclear war. But like Stratcom, Site R was designed to withstand a direct hit from a 1 megaton weapon, not a barrage of warheads decimating everything around as far as the eye can see. The President of the United States, lying on the forest floor some 45 miles to the southeast, becomes a casualty of this nuclear deluge. His body catches on fire and he carbonizes. The next targets hit by a volley of Russian submarine-launched ballistic missiles are in Colorado. At the Missile Warning Center inside Cheyenne Mountain, at NORAD headquarters at Peterson Space Force Base in Colorado Springs, and at Buckley Space Force Base in Aurora, these nuclear warfighting facilities and all their supporting facilities absorb multiple MIRVed Russian warheads all at once. For the more than 1 million people living here at the eastern foot of the Rocky Mountains, it is as if the whole world has been set on fire. Another stream of 100 kiloton warheads strikes multiple military targets across numerous states. The intention is to destroy all redundant components of U.S. nuclear command and control in a matter of minutes. In Louisiana, Barksdale Air Force Base gets hit, the once mighty headquarters of Global Strike Command, home to the nation's nuclear-armed B-52 long-range bombers, is no more. In Montana, Malmstrom Air Force Base is annihilated by nuclear warheads. Malmstrom is the base that operates, maintains, and oversees 150 Minuteman III ICBMs. All of the Minuteman III ICBMs have launched from their silos and are now on a ballistic trajectory to strike Russia. Payback for Russia's decision to launch. In North Dakota, Minot Air Force Base, home to another arsenal of Minuteman III ICBMs, is similarly destroyed. Same goes for the F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming. On the East Coast, in the coastal town of Cutler, Maine, population 500, the VLF transmitter facility, providing one-way communications to the Navy's ballistic missile submarines, is hit and destroyed. Same goes for the Jim Creek Naval Radio Station outside Arlington in Washington State, and for a third facility in Lualualei, Hawaii, a large coastal valley in Oahu whose name translates as Beloved One Spared. As this final blitzkrieg of SLBM warheads strikes and destroys their targets, all that remains of America's nuclear command and control are its doomsday planes in the air and its Trident submarines at sea. As the 1960 Single Integrated Operational Plan for General Nuclear War foretold, the war is now just about numbers, about a mass extermination plan that leaves billions of human beings dead. 58 minutes, Aviano Air Base, Italy. Targets across Europe get hit at the same time. A slew of the Russian SLBMs launched from the Arctic Ocean hit NATO bases across Europe. In a ruinous barrage of nuclear explosions, air bases in Belgium, Germany, the Netherlands, Italy, and Turkey become consumed in fire and obliterated by blast. Nuclear warheads inside Russian MIRVed ICBMs fly on depressed trajectories and strike London, Paris, Berlin, Brussels, Amsterdam, Rome, Ankara, Athens, Zagreb, Tallinn, Tirana, Helsinki, Stockholm, Oslo, Kyiv, and other targets in a wave of mass extermination. All enemies of Russia from the Russian military's point of view. Obliterated in this mayhem are not just the millions of people living, working, and visiting these places, but also scores of civilizations' engineering masterpieces, Rome's Colosseum, Notre Dame de Paris, Hagia Sophia, Stonehenge, the Parthenon, iconic representations of human ingenuity and imagination disappear in a succession of nuclear fireballs. The Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, the Banja Bashi Mosque in Bulgaria, the National Library of Finland, Estonia's Tumpia Castle, the Temple of Augustus in Ankara, Big Ben. Like everything in Washington, D.C., it was all there one moment, and then, just seconds later, gone. 59 minutes, the Atlantic Ocean. America is not done launching its own nuclear missiles. The Trident submarines receive final launch orders from doomsday planes flying over the ocean, as designed during the Cold War. These final launch messages allow U.S. aircraft to communicate with subsurface ballistic missile systems even after the U.S. electric grid has gone down, after U.S. nuclear command and control has unraveled and failed. These last U.S. launch orders are performed using the Very Low Frequency system, which transmits at 15 to 60 kilohertz, also known as the AN-FRC-117 Survivable Low Frequency Communication System. Flying in circles over the Atlantic Ocean, the last of the E-6B Doomsday Fleet airplanes deploys its 5-mile-long antenna. This long, thin wire trails out an opening in the back of the airplane until it becomes stabilized by a small parachute called a drogue. The E-6B airplane goes into a steep bank turn like a spiral, sending out its final nuclear launch messages one digit at a time. VLF bandwidth has a very low data transfer rate, just 35 alphanumeric characters per second. This is slower than the first generation dial-up modems, but fast enough to transmit final emergency action messages to Trident submarines thousands of miles away. Messages that, in turn, allow the Tridents to deliver one final nuclear blow as a follow-on punch to the entire U.S. nuclear triad of weapons that is presently on its way to targets across Russia. The commands are received. It will take another 15 minutes or so for the last of the Trident missiles to begin launch. No one in America, including the submarine crews, will end up knowing if or what these missiles hit. The epic, existential tragedy is that these last and final nuclear battle maneuvers cease to matter on anyone's scoreboard. Everyone loses. Everyone. 72 minutes, United States of America. At minute 72 of a conflict that began at 3:03 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 1,000 Russian nuclear warheads begin striking America in a 20-minute-long barrage of nuclear hellfire. 1,000 nuclear warheads strike a nation already decimated by 192 Russian SLBM warheads and 2 North Korean thermonuclear bombs. North Korea's third and final ICBM, launched from the Haejong-ni underground facility in Hwapyeong County, North Korea, failed upon re-entry. The barrage of 1,000 nuclear weapons strikes a nation already stripped of electricity and littered with the dead bodies of nuclear bomb blast victims, victims of radiation poisoning, of airplane, train, subway, and automobile crashes, of chemical explosions, of floods from burst dams. There are 1,000 flashes of light superheating the air in each ground zero to 180 million degrees Fahrenheit. 1,000 fireballs, each one more than a mile in diameter. 1,000 steeply fronted blast waves. 1,000 walls of compressed air, accompanied by several hundred mile per hour winds, pushing forward from the 1,000 fireballs, mowing down everything and everyone in the path. 1,000 American cities and towns, where all engineered structures in a 5, 6, or 7 mile radius change physical shapes, collapse, and burn. 1,000 cities and towns with molten asphalt streets. 1,000 cities and towns with survivors impaled to death by flying debris. 1,000 cities and towns filled with tens of millions of dead, with tens of millions of unfortunate survivors suffering fatal third-degree burns. People naked, tattered, bleeding, and suffocating. People who don't look or act like people anymore. 1,000 ground zeros transforming into 1,000 megafires, each soon to be burning over an area of 100 or more square miles. Across America and Europe, hundreds of millions of people are dead and dying, while hundreds of military aircraft fly circles in the air until they run out of fuel, while the last of the Trident submarines move stealthily out at sea, patrolling in circles until the crews run out of food, while survivors hide out in bunkers until they dare go outside or run out of air. Survivors who eventually, inevitably emerge from these bunkers to face what Nikita Khrushchev foresaw when he said, "The survivors will envy the dead." The world's first nuclear explosion occurred on July 16, 1945, at a site on the plains of the Alamogordo bombing range, known locally as the Jornada del Muerto. How the story of nuclear weapons began is how it will end. Jornada del Muerto, the journey of the dead man. Part 5. The next 24 months and beyond, or where we are headed after a nuclear exchange. Day 0. After the bomb stop, United States of America. It is very cold and it is very dark. The nuclear bombs sent aloft from all sides eventually stop striking targets. The high-yield ground and air bursts eventually cease. Across America, everything continues to burn: cities, suburbs, towns, forests. The smoke produced from burning skyscrapers and other tall buildings generates a noxious smog of pyrotoxins. Burning building materials, including fiberglass and insulation, spew cyanides, vinyl chloride, dioxins, and furans into the atmosphere. This haze of lethal smoke and gases kills survivors and further poisons the scorched earth. Large-scale 100 to 200 mile radius rings of fire push out from each of the 1,000 ground zeros across America. At first, there seems to be no end in sight to the destruction from these mass fires. With no pumped water to put anything out, these fires ignite new fires, trapping and killing people who manage to survive the initial mass extermination that came with the full-scale nuclear exchange. Across less densely populous areas of America, notably in the western states, forest fires rage. Coniferous trees in particular cannot handle radioactive fallout. They die and topple over, creating gigantic piles of kindling wood for ensuing fires. The intense firestorms create further apocalyptic conditions with cascading consequences. Oil and natural gas supplies, Coal seams and peat bogs burn for months on end. As a byproduct of all these cities and forests burning across America, and also across Europe, Russia, and parts of Asia, so intensely for so long, some 150 teragrams, about 330.6 billion pounds, of soot gets lofted into the upper troposphere and stratosphere. This black, powdery soot blocks out the sun. Its warming rays disappear. The density of soot would reduce global temperatures by roughly 27 degrees Fahrenheit, climatologist Alan Robach explains. In America, it would be more like a drop of 40 degrees Fahrenheit, slightly less near the oceans. The Earth plunges into a new horror called nuclear winter. The concept of nuclear winter first caught the world's attention in October 1983, when Parade magazine, then read by more than 10 million Americans, featured on its cover a spooky image of a darkened Earth and news of a special report inside, authored by one of the world's most famous scientists, Carl Sagan. Would nuclear war be the end of the world? Sagan asked, and answered, "In a nuclear exchange, more than a billion people would instantly be killed, but the long-term consequences could be much worse." Consequences that Sagan, his former students James B. Pollock and O. Brian Toon, and meteorologists Thomas P. Ackerman and Richard B. Turco laid out in terrifying detail in a paper published 2 months later in the journal Science. The paper was attacked by other scientists and by the Defense Department. "They said nuclear winter is irrelevant," recalls Professor Brian Toon, one of the original authors. "They called it Soviet disinformation." But behind closed doors, and in writings that have only recently seen the light of day, those at the very heart of the nuclear weapons complex knew the threat of nuclear winter was real. "The result of a large-scale nuclear exchange," wrote scientists with the Defense Nuclear Agency, "would be atmospheric trauma, and with serious potential for severe consequences for Earth's weather and climate." Of course, there are uncertainties with nuclear winter scenarios, physicist Frank von Hippel tells us today. But there's no uncertainty if you inject that much soot into the atmosphere after a full-scale nuclear war. In the original nuclear winter paper, the authors acknowledged their modeling had limitations. It was 1983. Computers were still in their infancy. And now, decades later, state-of-the-art modeling systems show atmospheric trauma from nuclear winter will, in fact, be even more severe. Our first models in 1983 said nuclear winter would last about 1 year, Toon explains. New data suggests the Earth's recovery time would be more like 10 years, that the sun's warming rays will reduce by roughly 70%. All life depends upon the sun. Sun equals life. Plants require sunlight to grow. Animals need plants for food. This includes Homo sapiens on the ground, birds in the air, worms in the soil, fish in the sea. The sun's energy drives Earth's ecosystem, the complex biological system of interacting organisms in which we all live. With billions of tons of sooty particles lofted into the atmosphere after a nuclear war, the structure of the Earth's troposphere changes. The troposphere is the first and lowest layer of the Earth's atmosphere, extending up to, on average, 7.5 miles in height. Most of the Earth's weather happens here. The troposphere holds all the air that plants need for photosynthesis and that animals need to breathe. It contains 99% of Earth's water vapor. After nuclear war, because of the alteration of the troposphere, the weather changes overnight. This is how the world becomes so cold and so dark. Temperatures plunge. Severe and prolonged low temperatures grip the Earth. The region worst affected is the mid-latitudes, the part of the northern hemisphere between 30 and 60 degrees latitude. This includes the United States and Canada, Europe, East Asia, and Central Asia. With these extreme temperature drops, summer weather becomes like winter. Toon says, new data shows that in places like Iowa and Ukraine, the temperature will not go above freezing for 6 years. When nuclear World War III began in this scenario, it was March 30th, early spring. In Los Angeles, the temperature plunges to below freezing. The killing frosts decimate tropical plant life and destroy crops across the region. In places like North Dakota, Michigan, and Vermont, where average temperatures hovered in the teens Fahrenheit, the temperature plunge means sub-zero weather for prolonged periods of time. Bodies of fresh water become entombed in thick sheets of ice. In the extreme north, Arctic sea ice expands by 4 million square miles, more than 50% greater than present-day ice sheets. Normally, ice-free coastal regions freeze over, leading to what modern geophysicists call a nuclear little ice age. The elements are not the only death sentence that looms. As the post-war weeks and months pass, survivors fighting the bitter cold become sick with radiation poisoning. Strontium-90, iodine-131, tritium, cesium-137, plutonium-239, and other radioactive products swept up into the mushroom clouds and dispersed around the Earth as fallout continue to contaminate the environment. Death by radiation is an excruciating way to die. As acute vomiting and diarrhea run their course, bone marrow and intestinal destruction sets in. The lining on victims' organs ruptures and hemorrhages. The insides of people's bodies liquefy as blood vessel lining sloughs away. These are grueling maladies to endure in a hospital, near impossible to overcome in the cold and the dark, on the run from firestorms and toxic smoke. Those who continue to live suffer chromosomal damage and blindness. Many will become sterile or semi-sterile, with reproductivity further reduced over time. There isn't enough uncontaminated food and water to go around. Humans fight for these resources. Only the ruthless survive. For 10,000 or 12,000 years, modern humans have depended on agriculture to survive. Agriculture is dependent on the Earth's ecosystem to produce food and supply fresh water to nourish people, animals, and plants. Months of cold and almost no sunlight after nuclear World War III triggers another series of fatal assaults on the Earth's ecosystem. Rainfall is reduced by 50%. This means the death of agriculture, the death of farming, the death of crops. After 10,000 years of planting and harvesting, humans return to a hunter-gatherer state. Before the war, meat and produce were grown on farms, shipped through the supply chain to distribution centers, supermarkets, stores, and farmers' markets. Legumes and cereals were among the staples stored locally in cities and towns. When transportation stopped, when there was no fuel to pump and no vehicles to drive, the distribution of food ceased. What was stored locally burned, radiated, froze, or has rotted. The people who survived the blast, wind, and fire effects of the initial nuclear war, who survived radiation poisoning and bitter cold, now begin starving to death. Across the Northern Hemisphere, killing frosts and sub-freezing temperatures destroy crops. Farm animals freeze to death or die of thirst or starvation. Humans are unable to start farming communities in rural areas far from ground zeros because there is very little left to grow. Months-long firestorms have heated soil to where the soil has become barren. Dormant seeds are damaged or dead. Severely malnourished survivors scavenge for roots and insects to eat, not unlike the starving citizens of North Korea before the war. The search for uncontaminated water rivals the quest for food. The radical temperature drop means that bodies of fresh water in the North Temperate Zone freeze over, in some places under a foot of ice. Getting surface water becomes a near impossible task for most humans. For many animals, it also means death. Lakes not frozen under deep sheets of ice have become contaminated with chemical waste products. When they finally unfreeze, they will be further poisoned by millions of thawing corpses. Water systems everywhere are in ruin. Between the nuclear explosions and the ensuing megafires, America's oil and gas storage facilities ruptured and blew apart. Hundreds of millions of gallons of toxic chemicals have spilled into rivers and streams, poisoning the water and killing aquatic life. Toxins leach into the earth and drain down into the water table. Coastal areas, saturated in extreme fallout, are littered with dead marine life. Hurricane-level storms rage, the result of extreme temperature changes between land and maritime air masses. Survivors who make it to the water's edge in search of food have no means of getting out on the sea to fish. Filter feeding shellfish in shallow waters, mussels, snails, and clams have mostly been killed off by radiation poisoning. Those still living are deadly to consume. In streams, lakes, rivers, and ponds, a mass extinction is underway. Reduced light devastates microscopic aquatic plant life. As phytoplankton die off, oxygen depletes, and the marine food chain disrupts, further destroying the ecosystem. After nuclear war and nuclear winter, photosynthesis can no longer keep up with plant metabolism. The plants begin to die. This happened 66 million years ago, after an asteroid struck Earth and shut out the sun. 70% of the species on the planet that we know of died, including all the dinosaurs, says Toon. They either starved or froze to death, and that a nuclear war would have many of the same phenomena that the dinosaurs experienced. Plants require sunlight for energy to grow shoots and fruits. Herbivores eat the plants. Carnivores eat the herbivores and each other. Everything on Earth lives and dies, breaks down and decomposes, all of it creating new soil in which new living things grow. This is the food chain, not anymore. After nuclear winter, the food chain breaks down. Nothing new grows in the cold and the dark. In this scenario, in all but a small region of the southern hemisphere, including Australia, New Zealand, Argentina, and parts of Paraguay, widespread famine grips the earth. The conclusion drawn in 2022 by 10 scientists working on 4 continents in a paper for Nature Food is succinct. More than 5 billion could die from a nuclear war between the United States and Russia. After many months, the cold and the dark become less severe. The intense effects of radioactive fog and haze diminish. The toxic smog dissipates. Light from the sun shines down on the earth once again. And with the sunlight comes yet another set of lethal consequences of nuclear war. The sun's warming rays are now killer ultraviolet rays. For millions of years, the ozone layer protected all living things from the sun's harmful ultraviolet rays, acting like a gentle shield. Not after nuclear war. Nuclear explosions and the ensuing firestorms inject mass amounts of nitrous oxides into the stratosphere. As a result, more than half the ozone layer is in ruin. A 2021 study on extreme ozone loss following nuclear war, conducted with computational support by the National Science Foundation, found that after a 15-year period, the ozone would lose as much as 75% of its shielding power worldwide. Survivors must move underground, into the damp and the dark, into spaces infested with spiders and insects like sucking louse. Above ground, as the sunlight dawns, things are as vile as they are below. In this new spring, a great thawing begins. This includes the thawing out of millions of frozen corpses now rotting in the unfiltered sun. First, there was cold and famine. Now, there is harsh sunlight, pathogens, and plague. Insects swarm. The warm weather after nuclear winter becomes a breeding ground for disease. A study by the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation found that insects are far less sensitive to radiation than vertebrates, owing to their physiology and short life cycles. Hordes of winged and multi-legged bugs are everywhere and multiplying. Many of these insects' natural predators, like birds, have mostly been killed off by the cold and the dark. The return of the sun's warming rays brings with it massive outbreaks and epidemics of insect-borne diseases like encephalitis, rabies, and typhus. A grand evolutionary shift is underway, like after the dinosaurs. In this post-nuclear world, the tiny-bodied, fast-reproducing species thrive, while the large-bodied animals, including humans, struggle at the edge of extinction. The question remains, will nuclear weapons bring on the end of the species that made these nuclear weapons in the first place? Only time will tell if we humans will survive. 24,000 years later, United States of America. Years pass, hundreds of years, thousands of years. The life-sustaining capacity of the terrestrial environment, greatly reduced at first, becomes revitalized and rejuvenated. Temperatures return to pre-war conditions. New species develop and thrive. So much has been damaged But planet Earth has a way of always recovering and repairing herself, at least so far. The soil rebounds, as does the quality of the water supply. The ultraviolet rays that sent human survivors underground have softened and become nurturing again. If human beings do survive, how will they begin anew? And will these new humans of the future become archaeologists? Will they ever know we were once all here? 10,000, 20,000, 24,000 years pass, roughly twice as long as the approximate amount of time it took for humans to evolve from hunter-gatherers to today. The radiation poisoning from nuclear World War III has naturally decayed. Will future humans find any traces of us, of our societies that we once built, advanced, and made thrive? If so, perhaps that discovery will be like the discovery story of a German archaeologist named Klaus Schmidt and a young graduate student named Michael Morsch. One day in October 1994, Schmidt made a discovery in remote Turkey that rewrote civilization's timeline, pushing it back thousands of years. This discovery remains shrouded in puzzles and mysteries. But the place exists as a metaphor for all of us as civilized people, for all that we know, and at the same time, for all that we don't know about our collective future and past. Klaus Schmidt was familiar with this area owing to an archaeological dig he'd been working on at the time, and he was made curious by a story he'd heard in the villages around the nearby city of Sanliurfa. It was said there was a hill in a valley not far away, a place where an abundance of flintstone could be found, poking out of the earth. Flintstone, a sedimentary rock, was used by early humans to make stone tools and start fires back in the Stone Age. Schmidt asked around the villages to see if anyone was familiar with this place, which, decades earlier, had apparently been misidentified by an American archaeologist named Peter Benedict as being some kind of medieval cemetery. Misidentified, then forgotten about. Until, that is, an elderly man in Orange-Sikkoi, Savak Yildiz, told Schmidt, yes, he knew about this place. Locals called it Göbekli Tepe Ziyaret, or the Potbellied Hill Pilgrimage Site. The way to find the site, said Yildiz, was to look for a lonely tree on top of a hill. And because this tree was the only thing growing in an otherwise vast expanse of desolate terrain, it was said to have magical powers. People called it the wishing tree and would journey there, Yildiz told Schmidt, to present important desires to the branches and thus the wind. In his book, Göbekli Tepe, a Stone Age sanctuary in southeastern Anatolia, Schmidt recalled how Yildiz helped arrange for a taxi driver to take him to this mysterious site, and for a local teenage boy to act as a guide. Accompanying Schmidt on the journey that day was the archaeology graduate student Michael Morsch. Morsch tells us how the area outside the bustling city of Sanliurfa was a vast and barren wasteland. Hundreds of square miles of red-brown earth littered with stones and patches of dry grass, Morsch recalls. Very little could flourish there, or so it seemed. It was as if no one had ever lived there at all. They drove for 8 miles until the road came to an end. The group exited the taxi and began walking along a goat path toward what was rumored to maybe be the site in question. We moved through a bizarre landscape of black-gray stone blocks, which again and again made little barriers, Schmidt wrote, forcing us to change our course to the left and to the right, zigzagging as if walking through an ankle-high labyrinth of natural stone. Finally, the group reached the end of this strange terrain, which opened up to a wide expanse where one could see for miles, all the way to the horizon. Looking out over the land, Schmidt felt disappointment. Nowhere was the slightest archaeological trace, only those of flocks of sheep and goats which were taken here every day to their barren meadows, he lamented. Then he saw the tree. It was almost a picture postcard image, Schmidt wrote. The wishing tree, alone on the highest peak of the mound, obviously marking a ziyaret. Of course, thought Morsch, a pilgrimage site. We had found Göbekli Tepe, Morsch recalls of that moment in time. But what was here, with his scientist's eye, Schmidt wondered, which of nature's powers could be supposed to have created this pile of earth on the highest part of this limestone ridge? In other words, what or who made this hill? A geologist might say that the hill was created by movement from the earth's plates. A religious man might invoke God. Schmidt, an archaeologist, recognized right away that what he was looking at was a man-made tell. A tell is an artificial topographical feature consisting of material left behind by generations of humans who once lived there. Excitement rose within him. As it turned out, he had discovered a lost civilization, lost for nearly 12,000 years. But not only that, Klaus Schmidt had found something that would change modern man's very definition of civilization itself, of how the very human concept of science and technology systems first came to be. Schmidt and a team of archaeologists began excavating the hill. They discovered pot shards and stone walls. They discovered huge pieces of quarried stone carved with wild animals like fox, vultures, and cranes. They discovered giant T-shaped pillars standing upright nearly 20 feet tall. But most important of all, they discovered a vast system of rooms, halls, and open-air auditoriums, spaces with benches and altars carefully carved of this same stone, brought here mysteriously from a stone quarry located many miles away. Before this find, scientists' general view of civilization was that science and technology had been born out of agriculture, out of farming, that only after humans had learned to domesticate plants and animals did they transition from the nomadic hunter-gatherers they once were to become civilized, to build communities and societies, to design and create complex systems of things. Göbekli Tepe disrupted this long-held foundational idea. The site was constructed by prehistoric architects, builders, and engineers. Architects who existed before agriculture and farming came to be. Hunter-gatherer humans who dreamed up this science-based project known to us today as Göbekli Tepe. They organized work parties to carry out what they had to have carefully and systematically mapped out or imagined in their minds. These were hunter-gatherer humans with a complex system of systems in play, with an elegant understanding of a system's architecture, of hierarchical command and control. As of early 2024, no living quarters have yet been found at Göbekli Tepe. No cemeteries, no bones. In other words, people didn't live here, it seems, but they gathered here for centuries.